Good morning. We're going to get started. I was telling someone that this morning was the first morning that I woke up hearing birds chirping instead of a snowplow. That's encouraging. So this morning we have Joe Lee, who's the director and general manager of WAER Public Media at Syracuse University. And Joe has been there for 25 years. He came to Syracuse from Baltimore, Maryland, where he served as program director for WEAA-FM at Morgan State University. Chris Bolt has been at WAER since 1990, serving as news and public affairs director since 1995. He has covered numerous issues in Syracuse and Central New York, including local poverty, government, health and wellness, environment, and many others. Chris received an education doctorate from St. John Fisher College and a master's degree in broadcast journalism from SU's Newhouse School. Please join me in welcoming Joe and Chris.
Thank you very much. Well, you just did my slide number two, so I don't have to do that now. But no, thank you very much. I want to thank you all for inviting us here this morning to talk about our little project with you. It's been a year or so in the making, from conception to launch. So we could tell you about it in probably about 10 minutes. So I thought it'd be more interesting to talk about how we got to where we are with this. As we were introduced, I'm Joe Lee. I'm the general manager of WAER. Chris Bolt is our news and public affairs director. And between us, we have over 50 years of public media experience. Our story starts back in 2016 when I traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to attend the super regional meeting. A super regional meeting in public media is a gathering of public radio leaders from around the country. We're talking individual stations, we're talking independent producers, and we're talking networks like National Public Radio, Public Radio International, and American Public Media. And we get together every year to talk about the issues that public radio is facing, what our opportunities are, what our threats are, just everything from management issues to content to new strategies. So it's usually a pretty open meeting with an agenda to come. And I went there that year, as I do every year. It's in a different place to learn from my colleagues. And I promise you, it wasn't because I'm the biggest Pittsburgh Steeler fan in the world, which I am. And I just love to visit Pittsburgh. But it was good. So it was a great meeting. But prior to going there, the sort of issue that had us all talking was an article that was done by the Wall Street Journal back in June of 2016. It was called Public Radio's Existential Crisis. And it dominated the conversation. The article suggested that NPR was struggling to adapt to the digital age. And while there was a point to be made about that, and a point to be made about the growing popularity of podcasting, using the word struggle, I believe, was misleading. In fact, NPR is a leader in digital content development. In fact, if you are a podcast listener, podcast user, when you look at the top of the charts of podcasts, usually there are NPR shows at the very top. And if not NPR, then you're looking at podcasts from other major public radio stations like WBUR in Boston, WNYC in New York City. So public radio is a leader in the podcast space. But that's not to say that there wasn't a point to be made. And that point is those at the very top of content development are the major networks and major radio stations. And so the point is that smaller stations, mid-sized stations, can fall behind if they're not playing in that space. And so the conversation kind of talked about how smaller and mid-sized stations can and need to be a part of a content revolution in public media. So we wanted to change the conversation. And the conversation shifted to opportunities for public radio stations to make deeper connections to the communities that they serve. In fact, recent research and major market success stories revealed that community engagement and impact journalism was an area that stations could show real community connectivity and value. Local news was a way to do it, local news that goes far beyond headlines, and it's what they were calling at this meeting, local that works. And if we want to preserve our integrated national local service, and that is our model, is to have national programming, national content mixed with valuable local content, we need stronger mid-size and small stations, especially in rural areas, capable of delivering their own version of local that works. And so that's what began to play out in our minds, is how do we play in that space? The traditional method of radio journalism and journalism in general is to go out into the community, collect stories, and then report back, sort of yell at you from on top of a hill, as it looks here. And that's what we do. We go out, we cover the stories of the day, we come back to the station, we put those stories together, and then we tell you about it. But there's no real connection between Chris and our news staff and you, our community. So what we learned were that there were stations in not-so-large markets doing some pretty innovative work. In Kansas City, Missouri, our colleagues at KCUR began to do a year-long project that they were calling Beyond Our Borders. And if you know about Kansas City, there are some very distinct lines that separate the state. I think it's in four quarters. And each of those sections of Kansas City has a very different sort of cultural reality. There are cultural identities that keep people separated within the state. And the question for KCUR was, how do we go about understanding what these differences are between our communities? How do we get them to tell us their stories about their perceptions of other folks and the perceptions of themselves? And how do we bring people together to talk about this in a way that builds community rather than separates? So we thought that was a very interesting project. Our neighbors to the north of us, North Country Public Radio, spent quite a bit of time telling stories of those living in the community that have served our country during times of war. They thought it was very interesting to learn about these folks, learn about their struggles, learn about their triumphs, and have storytelling, both on the radio and in public spaces, about how these folks come together to make a community. Again, connecting their journalism with community connection. Again, we thought that was a very interesting project as well. It's not hard news, but they're community stories. There was one project that caught my eye at that conference, and it was a project put on by Milwaukee Public Radio called Precious Lives. It's one place, 2 years, 100 stories. It was a 2-year, 100-part radio podcast series about young people and gun violence in Milwaukee. Homicide, suicide, accidental death, and the impact on family and community. And what they did was build a platform. They first created partnerships with other production companies, local newspapers, to figure out how they were going to go about covering stories of gun violence in their community and tell the stories of how they're impacting the lives of people. So they built a platform to tell those stories, to collect those stories, and offered it in podcast format. Again, this was a very visual, stunning presentation, and it just really connected to me how they were going about using their journalism and their storytelling to address a very serious problem in their community. It's a project that marries hard news reporting with storytelling and does so on a dedicated platform. And it's a partnership between 371 Productions and Milwaukee Public Radio that examines the toll that gun violence has on communities and families. Each episode of this project is told with documentary flair, and is presented in podcast format, allowing the producers to report and tell stories without the constraints of radio programming clocks. Podcasts can be very intimate. If you listen to podcasts, you're generally listening through some headphones. And we love this format because when Chris and his crew produce stories for WAR, if we're doing what we call impact stories, they have to fit a very specific format. How many minutes are we talking?
Yeah, I mean, many of you probably listen to public radio programs like All Things Considered or Morning Edition. It's very segmented. The clock is exactly the same every hour. So if we do a story that we do an in-depth piece, you know, say I did a series, for example, on the Underground Railroad and unknown aspects of that, those pieces had to fit exactly into NPR's clock. So if one story needed more time, you don't really have time because it has to fit exactly in the clock. The time periods are usually right around 4 minutes and right around 7 minutes. So again, if you listen, you probably maybe don't know that, but you next time you listen, you'll notice that we'll have a little break and then there'll be like a 7 minute gap. So if we do that local story, and some of these poverty stories already, as we'll talk about a little bit more, you just don't want those constraints. If somebody has a really intimate story they're telling you, the podcast format allows you to let them tell their story as long as it takes. And you've all also probably watched documentaries where even though it's one person telling one thing, the compelling content keeps you for longer. So the podcast format allowed us to do that and, you know, sort of spread our wings on those stories that allowed it.
And traditionally, when we do a story like that for radio, we're stepping on the NPR programming. So we have to take something away to give you something. And so if we want to tell a story that's going to take 13 minutes and 27 seconds, we want to do it in 13 minutes and 27 seconds and not the 8 minutes that we are constrained by the format clock. So that was one thing that really appealed to us about the Precious Lives piece was the use of podcast to tell these stories and do journalism, sort of breaking away from the traditional radio mold. And again, allowing a mid-sized station like Milwaukee Public Radio, larger than we are, but to play in that digital space and to produce programming that could be of great value to their community without interrupting other programming and other content sources on radio. So it's the community, what we call the community model of doing journalism. The question for me as I was sitting there was, how do we at WAER bring local journalism and a community model together? How do we get off of the hill, get down among folks, find out what the stories are, connect with people, and allow them to tell their stories? Meanwhile, back at home, the headlines were playing out. Going back to 2015, Syracuse's poverty rate remains among the worst in the nation, census finds. One in two children in Syracuse lives in poverty in a city that now ranks at that time 29th poorest in America. 32.1% of Syracuse residents lived below the poverty line in 2016, up from 31% in 2015. So these were headlines that were playing out back home. And it's a very serious issue in our community. And what we found when we were talking about it was that generally when these headlines come out, there's a few news stories about it, there's a little bit of conversation about it, and then, I don't know, 2-3 weeks later, you know, we're back to living our lives, we're back to doing what we do, we're back to working on other things, and the conversation stops. And the question for us was, how do we keep the conversation going so that we can help facilitate change? Now, it's not WAER's goal to end poverty. In fact,
well, it is our goal.
It is our goal, but we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. And so as we began to talk with potential funders, potential partners, and, you know, the question was always, you know, what are you trying to get out of this? How are you going to eliminate poverty? Well, that's not a goal of a radio station. Our goal is to get people talking about it. Our goal is to get people inspired to do something. Whether you want to volunteer for an organization. Perhaps we inspire you to philanthropy. Perhaps we inspire you to get involved in some other way. That's what we were hoping that we could do with this project, is to inspire people to come together to talk about this issue and work toward some change. But the statistics were alarming. Syracuse ranks 13th in the nation in poverty. Over 41,000 of Syracuse residents fall below the federal poverty line. 47% of Syracuse children live in poverty. 47% of Syracuse children live in poverty, just in case you didn't hear me the first time. Almost two-thirds of Syracuse black and Hispanic residents live in extreme poverty. So these were headlines that, as we began to look at them in aggregate, we felt even more compelled to do something. And that something was to put our journalism to work for this project. And so we decided that we would commit a year's worth of our effort in our news department reporting on issues of poverty in Syracuse so that we can keep the issue in front of folks, that we can inspire people to talk about it, inspire people to do something, perhaps inspire our local elected officials to act. And so we began to seek funding to fund this project. We wanted to do this in the vein of precious lives. And so we needed funding to create a platform to aggregate the stories that we were telling, to make them available to the general public. So we turned to the Central New York Community Foundation. We found that they themselves were obviously concerned about the poverty issue and began to make grants specifically addressing poverty. So the timing was perfect for us to approach them for a gift. We went into the grant round and we received a grant to produce the platform that would gather and house the stories that we told. And so the program began to take on a identity. And we'll show you a quick video.
At its core, poverty is about pushing down instead of having an opportunity to go up.
41,000 Syracuse residents were below the poverty line in 2016. What does poverty look like?
Deciding whether I feed my child or whether I put gas in the car to go to work.
What does it feel like?
It's, generally speaking, lack of access to opportunity.
The facts, the figures, the stories of our community.
Syracuse's 2016 poverty rate was 13th worst in the United States.
This is City Limits, a poverty project.
So after some consultation, we were calling it the Syracuse Poverty Project. People hated that. So we began to work with a local agency, Cowley & Associates. I know Gail Cowley is here in the audience. Thank you very much, Gail, to give this project an identity. And what we came up with was City Limits, a poverty project. They helped develop the assets, the visuals, the platform that was going to house the stories, and we're very proud of that. But that's what it began to be known as City Limits, a poverty project. And the website took shape. It's a platform very similar to the Precious Lives format. Each of the episodes is available at the very bottom of the website. You'll get the latest episode first, and then you can scroll back. So it's a giant media player, is what the website is, really. There's a section on there that has a map that outlines or shows some of the organizations that we've reported on, resources for people who need resources, and ideas if you want to get involved with an organization. Or choose to direct your philanthropy to an organization whose stories you heard on our project. Again, it's a podcast project that marries our journalism along with documentary-style storytelling in a format that's easily accessed. You can download it as a podcast. You can go to the website, play it on demand. You can also play it on demand from our website, waer.org. Anything you want to say about this part?
Only that to date, what's up there is a number of stories that have been really in-depth journalism. Another piece of this project is some panel discussions we've had, and some of the audio of those panel discussions, which were live on air, are also archived on that. So some of them about education and about poverty, kind of the difficulties of getting out of poverty when we launched the project, they're up there, and we have another panel coming up on poverty and the criminal justice system. So one of the things, I know Joe said podcasts a lot, and I do know that there's sort of an age gap with podcasts that I probably fall maybe a little above or below, I don't know. But as Joe mentioned, you can go to this website and just listen right on the website, and that could be done on a computer or a phone. So one of our goals was to make it available to the people who are podcast friendly, but also to somebody who just wants to listen on a computer or a phone that has internet access, so just to have it be as accessible as possible.
So what is City Limits? It's a year-long multi-platform civic engagement project produced by WAER Public Media that examines and explores poverty in Syracuse. It's a mix of journalism, storytelling, and community convening designed to spark community-wide dialogue between individuals, organizations, and other community constituencies. Each episode of this podcast project, or radio project, or on-demand project, will challenge assumptions on poverty and highlight one of many poverty-related issues, ranging from food insecurity to economic development to affordable housing and more. And that's in essence what the project is about. There is a episodes page that you can visit while there to scroll to look at the different stories that might be of interest to you, or you can play them again in succession, one after another. We encourage you to do that today, in fact. Just go on and listen to all of them. Each story will have elements of documentary storytelling, and many will be character-driven. So it's easy for us to go out and cover an issue and come back and tell you about it. Sometimes the difficult part is getting people, we thought, to participate and tell their own stories. But in the work that you've been doing, Chris, you found that people really want to tell their stories.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you think about documentaries or good storytelling, you want the people who are participating or affected by. And needless to say, it's part of news coverage on a daily basis, but really getting involved in people's lives, we've been kind of surprised about how people who are struggling and have had past things happen to them, either by chance or by their own actions, have been very generous telling their story, almost enthusiastic about telling their story. I'm feeling like to sort of get rid of just this very stereotypical myth about poverty. So people who are really, really struggling at, say, a women's shelter, you know, shared stories about their domestic violence past, their substance abuse past, their, you know, mismanagement of money and things that happened to them and things that they did. And, you know, those really personal stories of then, you know, how is the community dealing with this? How are programs working for them? How are they trying to work through? Are just much more compelling than hearing, you know, experts or the people who deliver those services, which is sort of the usual suspects in a quick-hitting news story. So, yeah, it's been really, really enlightening. I think it's added greatly to the project that a lot of people who, you know, are suffering the effects of poverty in one or another way have come forward to tell the stories. And it just makes the listening of the pieces just much more compelling. And I think it tells a story that, as Joe was talking about, if we're going to get people involved or talking, that's how to do it. Hearing the same voices saying the same things is not going to inspire much change. So hearing things at that level, I think, does have a much more likely impact on the community to the extent that we can.
We get asked a lot, who is this project for? It's for everyone. Primarily, it's for people like us in this room. Many of us that live outside the city limits, many of us that live in either rural or communities that are suburban and beyond the Syracuse limits. Many of us, quite frankly, who live in a bubble, who see it as someone else's problem, not our problem. And our belief is that it's everyone's problem. If the city is suffering, if the city is sick, if our neighbors are sick, that sickness is at some point going to spread to us in some form. And so if we're not all working to better this situation, I don't see how it gets done. You know, we can't move mass numbers of individuals from one economic strata to the next without a community effort. How are we getting the word out about this project? Obviously, through our own radio station. We're using traditional methods like billboards, as you see here, what's been somewhat of a controversial billboard design. We were intentionally trying to shock people, yes. There are a lot of people that are upset about this billboard. There are a lot of people who think we should only be presenting a very positive face of Syracuse. There are people that think that this is too in your face. And quite frankly, we want to get people upset. I don't think if we put up a billboard with just the logo that we're going to get people talking about this. So if you start the conversation by being upset, at least you've started the conversation. And we're also using non-traditional methods, marketing through social media and other ways as well. It's not just the podcast project or the on-demand project, as Chris mentioned. We're doing at least trying once a month or every other month to do what we call City Limits Talk. And they're hour-long talk shows that air on WAER Live that focus on a specific issue around poverty. Here you see pictures from our episode on education, poverty and education. We had educators from the Syracuse City School District. We had representation from OCC. We had healthcare workers all around the table talking about what they see on a daily basis, you know, what positive things are being done, what the challenges are, again, having a conversation about this. The very next one will be in May on legal aid, legal issues for people who are affected by poverty. That will be May 3rd, I believe. And you can catch that on live on WAER. Those will be recorded and then put on the City Limits website as well if you miss it. We also have a team of students working on video companion pieces to this. So a story that we do, they may go out and do a video version so that we can get those that are more stimulated by video content. We're trying to do at least four of those before the project is over. By the way, this project started, launched in December of 2017 and will go until early December of this year. And so by that time, we hope to have four or five video companion pieces with this project as well. The impact so far since launching December 1-ish, somewhere around there, just looking at boosting the episodes through social media platforms like Facebook, we've reached 51,000 people. There have been 196 comments varying from the very positive to the very negative, so you get a range of people's emotions and opinions on things. 2,500 link clicks, 2,900 video views, and that's all led to pushing that traffic to the City Limits Project website of 6,000 sessions and almost 7,900 page views for the website. Again, started early December. So we expect that to keep picking up as the project continues to get more recognition. We have a little bit of time before we do some question and answer, and so I thought we would play at least a portion of a story. And because I believe I see someone in the audience that who represents an organization that we profiled, I thought we would listen to this story from Scott Willis on a ride-sharing program in Syracuse that helps those without their own transportation and who can't get to work through public transportation. They help these folks get to their jobs on time so that they can maintain employment. So this is called a ride-sharing solution.
Thousands Syracuse residents were below the poverty line in 2016.
At its core, poverty is about pushing down instead of having an opportunity to go up.
It's, generally speaking, lack of access to opportunity.
This is City Limits, a poverty project.
Thanks for listening to City Limits. I'm Scott Willis. Think about this scenario. You're living in poverty and finally land a good-paying job, but you don't have a car or a reliable way to get to work. What would you do? There's the bus, if it comes and goes where and when you need it to. Cabs? Ride-sharing? Too expensive. Numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau show in 2016 nearly 30% of Syracuse residents didn't have access to a car. That's about the same as cities that are more walkable or have better public transportation like San Francisco, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. Transportation to and from work is critical for those trying to dig themselves out of poverty. But here in Syracuse, there aren't many answers, unless you're Deborah Hundley. A few years ago, she and others started looking into the problem and found that job candidates would go through training programs but had no way to get to work if they got a job. So she founded Providence Services and tried to figure out a cost-effective way to match people to job sites not well served by public transportation. Hundley settled with what she calls a modified van pool, where she contracts with livery companies to provide shuttles to and from work at a heavily discounted rate. Riders pay $5 to $7 each way. A small grant makes up the difference. I decided to find out how it works and meet some of those who seem to sincerely appreciate the reliable, affordable ride service. Now, for most of us, when it's time to go to work, we simply get in the car and don't give it a second thought. But for some Syracuse area residents, going through this routine isn't even in the cards.
My name is Herman Williams. I stay at 103 Dyer Court. I work at Burn Dairy out there off of Fly Road. And I've been out there 3 months.
I'm waiting outside the Western Lights Wegmans for the CNY Green Taxi. I'm about to join a few others who've arranged a ride to work at Spectrum near Carrier Circle. You see, these employees don't have a car. The bus schedule or routes just don't match their shift or location. And a traditional cab or ride-sharing service is simply too expensive. That's where a tiny nonprofit called Providence Services comes in. They provide transportation to work at a reduced rate for workers just trying to get ahead.
Without the service, I would have never had this job because I wasn't going to work there because I didn't have the transportation. Previous jobs I had, but I didn't have the means and the transportation to get there. So I would either call in or whatever, but the service that I got now with the rides working back, I could be there on time. The sky's the limit for me right now.
I think transportation is just overlooked. And, you know, I talk to people, the transportation, and their eyes sort of glaze over. And yet, if that was a disease, we'd be jumping in. We have to cure this. And there's so many jobs out there. You know, we communicate with companies, and they want to have a diverse workforce. They want that. The diversity is in the city, but they have to be able to get there.
I'm Nancy, by the way. I don't know if I said that.
I'm Scott. Thanks for allowing me to ride along.
Absolutely.
Our first stop is at Bellevue Heights Apartments, just down the street from the Western Lights Wegmans.
You find most people are on time?
Yes, within a few minutes.
Okay.
This first woman that we're picking up is frequently like 2 or 3 minutes late.
I've done somewhat of a deep dive into people, investing in people, and I've met an awful lot of wonderful people who have just not had opportunities, to be honest with you.
So if you want to hear more, you can go to citylimitsproject.org. Just want to give you a little taste, but for the sake of time, we'll begin to take some questions. But you get a sense of how the stories are told, the people that we're connecting to. And again, a part of our mission is to educate people, to challenge assumptions. This piece educated me. Listening to this particular story inspired my wife and I to make a contribution to Providence Services, a financial contribution. We take for granted how folks get to work. I've moved here 25 years ago. I've been driving ever since. I've never taken public transportation in this city. So I have no idea how people get around, how difficult it is or easy it is. And since we've done this story, I've been hearing more and more about some of the shortcomings of public transportation in this town. So, again, it's our job to help educate folks on what's going on in Syracuse, how people are affected, and what services are out there that might be able to help address that kind of issue. So I want to thank you all for inviting us here to talk about it. Again, the website is citylimitsproject.org. And if you have any questions, Chris will be happy to answer them.
Good morning. As you're talking about this whole program, obviously, it's focused on the city of Syracuse, and there's some easier things to get stats and everything else. But you mentioned about the bubble. I live in the town of Cicero and recently ran for public office and went to some areas of our town that I didn't fully appreciate that we had the poverty issue right there in Cicero. And I think to reach out to some of those towns throughout Onondaga County or other places you may want to go, I bet you could find those types of situations throughout. And we all think that things are the way it is where we may happen to hang our hat each night or something. And I think seeing it in the not rural areas, but in other towns, might get greater interest in the whole program that you're doing.
I mean, thank you for saying that. And I think you're 1,000% right, if that's a thing. The notion of suburban poverty is just starting to get some attention in sort of academic circles, and it's definitely a story idea that we're pursuing in the near future, because you're exactly right. The people who live in the subdivision houses that, you know, are $229,000 made by Ryan Holmes, that's not what we're talking about, but the towns and villages that have a reputation for a style of living also have elements and pockets of poverty, and in many cases the causes and effects are exactly the same on a smaller level. But yeah, I think your point is really valid, and I'm going to use it to motivate us to do more reporting in that, seeing that in Cicero, or whether it's in Fayetteville or Manlius, or whether it's in Camillus or pick your town, it would serve to engage you who live there more. Though I also don't want to divorce ourselves from the idea that if we live in the suburbs, I actually live downtown in the city, but if we live in the suburbs, we can't lose sight of the fact that how Syracuse goes is how the region goes. So if Syracuse poverty is crippling in a lot of ways, socially and financially, it's going to start dragging down the Ciceros and Fayettevilles and Camillus's as well. So, but your point is very valid that in order to get somebody engaged to look at poverty in the, you know, suburbs or near exurbs or whatever is definitely a way to get people engaged, and it definitely does exist.
Yeah, and if I can add, when we began to talk about how we would go about covering this, we did struggle a bit with making this a Syracuse City-only project or expanding. We said we would call it City Limits, but we would not limit ourselves to telling stories outside the area. And as you can imagine, as you probably know, Mobility is an issue. Probably it's worse in rural areas, in smaller towns, because you don't have even the public transportation infrastructure that Syracuse has. So mobility is an issue that can affect people all over. So we will be reaching out and telling stories from other areas as well.
I want to applaud your efforts in this area. I'm wondering, however, what your demographics of who your listeners are. I'm one of your demographics, right? But I'm wondering what the outreach beyond this is, because more and more we hear about how we've isolated ourselves into kind of media silos, where we're only listening to ideas that are consistent with our set of beliefs or our concerns or whatever.
That's a great question, and again, another reason we decided to make this a podcast project rather than a radio project, because we know the majority of people listening to us are going to fit your demographic. And so how do we reach other folks, other communities, and other demographics? And making this a podcast project and marketing it to those communities, that will allow people to subscribe to it, have it delivered on demand, or visit a website to get it. And that's why we've done the billboard campaign. So those are all throughout the city in various neighborhoods. And we can see from those that have connected to the City Limits Facebook page, you can actually see the diversity of people that are commenting and visiting and listening to the story. So we think that effort is working. Is there more we can do? Absolutely. What that is, haven't figured that out yet. So as we begin to move along, we'll be trying to figure out ways to reach more diverse populations. But again, one of the sections of the site is a resource section, and there's a map that has some of the various organizations and services out there. So we do want people who are affected to listen. So that's the split of audiences, is those that are affected, that we want to be able to allow a platform to tell their stories, have a voice, find resources, and then folks like you with extremely deep pockets that can turn to some of these organizations and say, how can I help? And we have anecdotal evidence of that beginning to happen. We know that agencies that we have spotlighted are reporting a little bump in philanthropy. And hopefully we'll see that in terms of volunteerism as well.
Can I just add one thing about that, too, is we're really trying to, whenever we do a story, get that story. I mean, if it shows up on the radio and you're the radio audience and that's it, you're right. That is a limited audience. That's who our audience is, who our demographic is. We know it's me and you. I mean, you know, I'm pushing 60 and that's who our audience is. So it's been really important to try to get the stories out in as many ways as possible. So we've really encouraged people to share, and you know that's through email links and it's through social media links. And just yesterday, I was with a woman who's a social worker in school, 25 years my junior probably, and she was talking about being engaged in the content and distributing it to, you know, her colleagues, et cetera. So it's kind of, we need that sort of spider web to go, because as Joe said, you could always do more, but we do have to think about it. I mean, you raise a great point. We have to think about it in every way possible, because that's who needs to be involved, just to get the content out. I mean, we're putting a lot of resources into it, financial, human resources. We figure it's about a 30% effort of our newsroom every day to produce the content, so that's taken away from other things. So it's a big investment for us, so we definitely want the content to be heard. So we're trying every way we know and are absolutely open to suggestions. Yeah, and something like this, you know, public presentations as well.
Yeah, if we did a two-part story on I-81, which, as you know, is a controversial subject. And it is the the piece that we've done that has had the most engagement. And if you were to look at the comments, again, ranging from extremely nasty to forward-thinking, and you look at the folks, it's a big, diverse, I mean, I would imagine that the majority of those folks that are that have accessed that story are not our typical listeners. So we're doing that by boosting these through Facebook, through targeted measures. And so we're going beyond our audience. And if quickly I can, because Chris talked about the resources, we did get the grant from the Central New York Community Foundation. We have corporate support from Wegmans and Grossman St. Amour as well. So we want to thank those organizations for allowing us to do this work. Yes.
Are you training your reporters because of this project to ask better and more insightful questions when they do go out for their regular reporting responsibilities? It seems to me that is one of the most important gaps that stations like you could fulfill for our society, is to ask the real questions that need to be asked.
I'll allow Chris to jump in. We do have editorial meetings around this and how to talk about how we approach this in a sensitive matter. I think when we began the journey, there were a lot of people.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about regular reporting, not this project.
Oh, not this.
Is this project teaching anybody in the news gathering business to ask better questions of elected officials, fancy people, that type of thing?
Fancy, yeah. The fancy people questions, I believe so. There's no formal component of that. But what we are hoping is that this project allows us to elevate our normal journalism, everything that we do on a normal basis. Because what we typically do is general assignment reporting. So we go out, we'll cover a story, we'll ask some basic questions. This project allows us to dig deeper, to ask questions that go beyond the who, what, where, and when. Is that answering your?
No. Every time the city or the county gives a tax exemption to a business that's being built where you can't get to without a car, is somebody asking the question, how will the employees get there?
Yes.
I mean, that's the type of question that needs to be asked.
Yeah.
Well, it's
no questions.
The answer to your question is no, people don't typically ask those questions. The other answer is that this kind of reporting at least opens eyes to saying, hey, let's dig a little bit deeper. The tenet of daily news, unfortunately, is that that story is, 45 seconds to a minute and a half. And unfortunately, and frustratingly for journalists who've lived here for 30 years and covered this stuff and have all the frustrations that you have, it's more difficult to do that. That's no excuse, believe me. So I would say that just raising the fact, it's a good point to talk about. The editorial meetings that Joe's talking about on a subject like this do allow us to think about it enough to say, what are those questions? Unfortunately, again, and again, it's not an excuse, but the daily news reporting, and Stan could probably back that up, is when you just run to something and get the soundbite for the story, unfortunately, it's not the depth you'd like. But we endeavor to do better always, and your point is well taken.
And there will be, before the project's over, there will be a component of policy, reporting on policy and decisions that affect people's lives on a daily basis, particularly as it relates to poverty. So there will be policy reporting, if you will, that will get to those kinds of questions.
I was curious as to what your relationship was, editorially speaking, with Syracuse University. And then the second question I have is, what's a podcast?
Well, we are we're a department of Syracuse University. So the work that we're doing is a representation of the university's desire to make an impact in the community. So this is the work that we do on a daily basis. A podcast is an audio project, and it can be anything from journalism to entertainment to jibber jabber. It's a platform that allows people ordinary people, in fact, to record audio work, put it on a platform where you as an end user can subscribe to it, have it delivered straight to your phone or to your computer, and listen anytime that you want. So it's on-demand audio listening. But the subject matter can range from entertainment to journalism to anything you want it to be.
Can I just say something about the one thing that I think it's important to know about Syracuse University and WAER? I'm a university employee, and needless to say, we have resources from Syracuse University that help pay a portion of our budget, though we do have to raise our own funding for most things, including this project. The great thing about us, as opposed to many, many other university licensees, which is a common public radio format or business model, is that we have no editorial pressure from the university. No one has ever said, cover this or don't cover that, ever. And I've been there for 30 years as a student and an employee. So we have a great relationship, probably because of the Newhouse School. The administration might have other ideas, but the Newhouse School, to stay journalistically solid, would always run interference for us. So we actually have a great relationship in the sense that we are never guided editorially. We have the control of that. And now, let me just say, if there's some tremendously negative story about the university, we'll cover it. We'll make sure the university has every opportunity to respond to that. And we've had those examples. You know, we've had examples of them not doing the right things regarding asbestos on projects. We've had union complaints. We've had student protests. We've had, you know, sexual misdeeds by professors, you know, all of which have been on our air. Like I said, we certainly turn over every rock to make sure the university has an opportunity to respond. But we have a great editorial freedom, even though they could pull the plug, they could fire me, they could end our license. So just to say, I feel we're very lucky in that regard.
An idea. You asked for an idea. My son was the news director for New Hampshire Public Radio. He came up with the idea of having a or 1 hour, 1.5 hour time in New Hampshire on talking just about New Hampshire. And the other three parts of the All Things Considered, the other three segments, were national. He had the local, and he had it as the third part before the fourth, and it worked. But I'm just thinking, here in Syracuse, we've had an idea that has gone international, but it has really helped people that are poor. And that's Ruth Colvin's Literacy Volunteers. Well, there's another one that's coming along right this very minute, and that's A Tiny Home. Are you working on something like that? There's one where you have an individual coming up with an idea, carrying it out on a very small basis to begin with. Each year it's growing. Do you have anything like that going?
Yes, we will be addressing this. The way we're approaching the project is in sort of sections. And so we will be getting, right now we're dealing with sort of causes and effects and impacts. We will be doing more on housing, affordable housing. We're going to get to a section that deals with that. And then we'll move on to things like policy. So we do plan on covering
the
tiny home project.
Andrew Linetta?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Andrew Linetta. And yeah, one of the elements of the storytelling is we're calling on the front lines, and those are kind of targeted, very narrow stories about agencies. And I wanted to have Andrew as one of the on the front lines stories. So I do really like that idea, and having them put it in the context of this is a novel thing. The tiny home movement is a novel thing that some people see as, I don't know, kind of back to the land, or people who live very alternative lifestyles might have their tiny home. There's even an HGTV show about, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 tiny homes that have spas in them and everything else. And it's a confection. But What Andrew talks about is his tiny homes as an inexpensive way to provide housing to people who otherwise wouldn't have it. So that's the story that we would want to tell, which is, I'm sure, the thing that you're interested in, John.
Good morning. Have you been working with the HOPE Project, Oshakeaton, and how is that working?
Yes, we often use OSHA and that project as a source of direction and information. They participated, both OSHA and Sharon Owens participated in our initial kickoff roundtable, which discussed poverty in general. And she's been in several of our stories and is a source of information and direction for us.
Thank you very much. Two questions. One, I think, is a quick one. First one, if you take a visit around the Syracuse City Schools, you'll see that it's almost as if Brown versus the Board of Education never existed. The schools are highly segregated, and that's closely connected to poverty. And I wonder how much the podcasts have dealt with that issue specifically. And my other question is, what are you going to do when your grant money runs out?
Well, grant money,
come back here.
I'll start with that first. Again, it's a year-long project. Once we're done with the reporting, the site will stay active. We will continue with our own resources to contribute to it as we can. With regard to segregation, we addressed that in the I-81 piece. We talked about how the development of I-81 sort of fed to segregation and poverty. We also addressed the school issue in our education roundtable, but that's not to say that we're not going to explore that further. We will still be looking at that issue, but it's a very important issue. It's one that a lot of people don't like to talk about.
And I would encourage you to go to the city schools and get some of these storytelling segments from the actual students, because they're phenomenal storytellers.
Yeah, Chris is a piece coming up that that deals a bit with that. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, actually, the next piece I'm working on, it's actually not student-focused. It's focused on the social workers in schools and just the myriad issues that literally every day they have to help deal with, or I won't say solve because they're never solved, but, you know, just to get a kid in a third grade class, all the things that went into that. So that's one of my On the Front Lines pieces, is that. But that's going to lead to more stories from students themselves. It's a little hard getting to students under the grade of 5. You know, it's the process of getting them to approve to tell us. But the connection in the schools between especially the social workers and a lot of the principals, they're really helpful because they do want to have those stories out there. So yeah, it's something we'll continue to do through the whole project because it's just so important. Every single story we've done, the word education comes up as like just this absolutely essential thing that needs to be improved. And the segregation in schools and the lack of resources in schools. And as I said, all the issues that they have to do before anybody ever sits in math class or English class, you know, is something that really needs a lot more light shown upon it.
Hi, I'm just back from 3 months away from Syracuse, and this is a bracing reentry conversation here. But thank you for what you're doing. And I just want to ask about the sort of nature of poverty in Syracuse. So many people have tried so hard to address this issue over the years, and we still have one of the poorest cities in America. And I wonder if this project is diving deep enough so that you can help us figure out why Syracuse has so many poor people. And I don't want to sound cynical, but maybe we're one of the most poverty-friendly cities in America. You know, the poor say, you know, hey, come on over here. You know, if you're poor, come to Syracuse. What is it about Syracuse that creates this demographic? And, you know, even before we try to solve it or succeed in solving it, don't we have to understand that?
I don't know that this project will get to that level, but we hope to play a convening part. So a part of this project is to have at least 2 convening meetings with groups like this, where we can get together and discuss that, and hopefully through that discussion we can get to that level. But once we begin looking at that, it gets to be what we call mission creep. So the mission for this project is to tell the stories, to report on what's going on. And I think getting at the deep core of where we go from here is the work that has to happen from the people that we inspire. And so, again, we are trying to play a role where we facilitate that kind of conversation. But I don't know between now and December that we'll get to that level of this issue.
So please join me in thanking Chris and Joe for spending some time with us this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. And let me just say, if anyone has another idea, a source, a story idea, something you'd like to see addressed, I can't guarantee we'll get to everything because it is a lot of work for each piece, but please contact us through the website. All of our emails are there. I'd absolutely love to hear about any source or any story idea. There's never too much information. So thank you.